Chapter 5. Had taken, in Mrs. Boykin's case, the shape or rather the multiple shapes of a series of culinary feats, of gastronomic combinations, which would have commanded her deep respect had she seen them on any other table, and which she naturally relied on to produce the same effect on her guest. Whether or not the desired result was achieved, Madame de Trame's manner did not specifically declare, but it showed a general complaisance, a charming willingness to be amused, which made Mr. Boykin, for months afterward, allude to her among his compatriots as an old friend of my wife's takes potluck with us, you know. Of course there's not a word of truth in any of those ridiculous stories. It was only when, to Durham's intense surprise, Mr. Boykin hazarded to his neighbor the regret that they had not been so lucky as to secure the prince, it was then only that the lady showed, not indeed anything so simple and unprepared as embarrassment, but a faint play of wonder, an under flicker of amusement, as though recognizing that, by some odd law of social compensation, the crudity of the talk might account for the complexity of the dishes. But Mr. Boykin was tremulously alive to hints, and the conversation at once slid to safer topics, easy generalizations which left Madame de Trame's ample time to explore the table, to use her narrow gaze like a knife slitting open the unsuspicious personalities about her. Nanny and Katie Durham, who, after much discussion, to which their hostess candidly admitted them, had been included in the feast, were the special objects of Madame de Trame's observation. During dinner she ignored in their favor the other carefully selected guests, the fashionable art critic, the old legitimist general, the beauty from the English embassy, the whole impressive marshalling of Mrs. Boykin's social resources, and when the men returned to the drawing room, Durham found her still fanning in his sisters the flame of an easily kindled enthusiasm. Since she could hardly have been held by the intrinsic interest of their converse, the sight gave him another swift intuition of the working of those hidden forces with which Fanny de Malreux felt herself encompassed. But when Madame de Trames, at his approach, let him see that it was for him as he had been reserving herself, he felt that so graceful an impulse needed no special explanation. As he had the art of making it seem quite natural that they should move away together to the remotest of Mrs. Boykin's far-drawn salons, and that there, in the glaring privacy of brocade and ormolu, she should turn to him with a smile which avowed her intentional quest of seclusion. "Confess that I have done a great deal for you," she exclaimed, making room for him on a sofa judiciously screened from the observation of the other rooms. "In coming to dine with my cousin?" he inquired, answering her smile. "Let us say, in giving you this half hour. For that I am duly grateful, and shall be still more so, when I know what it contains for me. Ah, I am not sure. You will not like what I am going to say." "Shall I not?" he rejoined, changing color. She raised her eyes from the thoughtful contemplation of her painted fan. "Why, you appear to have no idea of the difficulties. Should I have asked your help if I had not had an idea of them? But you are still confident that with my help you can surmount them? I can't believe you have come here to take that confidence from me." She leaned back, smiling at him through her lashes. "And all this, I am to do for your beaux? No, for your own. That you may see with them what happiness you are conferring. You are extremely clever, and I like you." She paused, and then brought out with lingering emphasis, "But my family will not hear of a divorce." She threw into her voice such an accent of finality that Durham, for the moment, felt himself brought up against an insurmountable barrier. But, almost at once, his fear was mitigated by the conviction that she would not have put herself out so much to say so little. "When you speak of your family, do you include yourself?" he suggested. She threw a surprised glance at him. I thought you understood that I am simply their mouthpiece." At this he rose quietly to his feet with a gesture of acceptance. I have only to thank you, then, for not keeping me longer in suspense." His air of wishing, to put an immediate end to the conversation seemed to surprise her. Sit down a moment longer, she commanded him kindly, and as he leaned against the back of his chair, without appearing to hear her request, she added in a low voice, I am very sorry for you and Fanny, but you are not the only persons to be pitied. He had dropped her light manner as she might have tossed aside her fan, and he was startled at the intimacy of misery to which her look and movement abruptly admitted him. Perhaps no Anglo-Saxon fully understands the fluency in self-revelation which centuries of the confessional have given to the Latin races, and to Durham, at any rate, Madame de Tram's sudden avowal gave the shock of a physical abandonment. I am so sorry, he stammered, is there any way in which I can be of use to you? She sat before him with her hands clasped, her eyes fixed on his in a terrible intensity of appeal. If he would. Oh, there is nothing I would not do for you. I have still a great deal of influence with my mother, and what my mother commands we all do. I could help you, I am sure I could help you, but not if my own situation were known. And if nothing can be done, it must be known in a few days. Durham had reseated himself at her side. Tell me what I can do, he said in a low tone, forgetting his own preoccupations in his genuine concern for her distress. She looked up at him through tears. How dare I? Your race is so cautious, so self-controlled you have, so little indulgence for the extravagances of the heart. And my folly has been incredible and unrewarded. She paused, and as Durham waited in a silence which she guessed to be compassionate, she brought out below her breath, I have lent money my husband's, my brother's money, that was not mine, and now I have nothing to repay it with. Durham gazed at her in genuine astonishment. The turn the conversation had taken led quite beyond his uncomplicated experiences with the other sex. She saw his surprise, and extended her hands in deprecation and entreaty. Alas, what must you think of me? How can I explain my humiliating myself before a stranger? Only by telling you the whole truth, the fact that I am not alone in this disaster, that I could not confess my situation to my family without ruining myself, and involving in my ruin someone who, however undeservedly, has been as dear to me as you are to, Durham pushed his chair back with a sharp exclamation. Even that does not move you, she said. The cry restored him to his senses by the long shaft of light it sent down the dark windings of the situation. He seemed suddenly to know Madame de Tram's, as if he had been brought up with her in the inscrutable shades of the Hotel de Malherbe. She, on her side, appeared to have a startled but uncomprehending sense of the fact that his silence was no longer completely sympathetic, that her touch called forth no answering vibration, and she made a desperate clutch at the one chord she could be certain of sounding. You have asked a great deal of me, much more than you can guess. Do you mean to give me nothing, not even your sympathy in return? Is it because you have heard horrors of me? When are they not said of a woman who is married unhappily? Perhaps not in your fortunate country, where she may seek liberation without dishonor. But here, you who have seen the consequences of our disastrous marriages, you who may yet be the victim of our cruel and abominable system, have you no pity for one who has suffered in the same way, and without the possibility of release? She paused, laying her hand on his arm with a smile of deprecating irony. It is not because you are not rich. At such times the crudest way is the shortest, and I don't pretend to deny that I know I am asking you a trifle. You Americans, when you want a thing, always pay 10 times what it is worth, and I am giving you the wonderful chance to get what you most want at a bargain. Durham sat silent, her little gloved hand burning his coat sleeve, as if it had been a hot iron. His brain was tingling with the shock of her confession. She wanted money, a great deal of money. That was clear, but it was not the point. She was ready to sell her influence, and he fancied she could be counted on to fulfill her side of the bargain. The fact that he could so trust her seemed only to make her more terrible to him, more supernaturally dauntless and baleful. For what was it that she exacted of him? As he had said, she must have money to pay her debts, but he knew that was only a pretext which she scarcely expected him to believe. She wanted the money for someone else. That was what her allusion to a fellow victim meant. She wanted it to pay the prince's gambling debts. It was at that price that Durham was to buy the right to marry Fanny de Malreuve. Once the situation had worked itself out in his mind, he found himself unexpectedly relieved of the necessity of weighing the arguments for and against it. All the traditional forces of his blood were in revolt, and he could only surrender himself to their pressure, without thought of compromise or parley. He stood up in silence, and the abruptness of his movement caused Madame de Trame's hand to slip from his arm. "You refuse?" she exclaimed, and he answered with a bow colon, "Only because of the return you propose to make me." She stood staring at him, in a perplexity so genuine and profound that he could almost have smiled at it through his disgust. "Ah, you are all incredible," she murmured at last, stooping to repossess herself of her fan, and as she moved past him to rejoin the group in the farther room, she added in an incisive undertone, "You are quite at liberty to repeat our conversation to your friend." Durham did not take advantage of the permission thus strangely flung at him. Of his talk with her sister-in-law he gave to Madame de Malreuve only that part which concerned her. Presenting himself for this purpose, the day after Mrs. Boykin's dinner, he found his friend alone with her son, and the sight of the child had the effect of dispelling whatever illusive hopes had attended him to the threshold. Even after the governess's descent upon the scene had left Madame de Malreuve and her visitor alone, the little boy's presence seemed to hover admonishingly between them, reducing to a bare statement of fact Durham's confession of the total failure of his errand. Madame de Malreuve heard the confession calmly, as he had been too prepared for it, not to have prepared a countenance to receive it. Her first comment was, "I have never known them to declare themselves so plainly," and Durham's baffled hopes fastened themselves eagerly on the words. Had she not always warned him that there was nothing so misleading as their plainness? And might it not be that, in spite of his advisedness, he had suffered too easy a rebuff? But second thoughts reminded him that the refusal had not been as unconditional as his necessary reservations made it seem in the repetition, and that, furthermore, it was his own act, and not that of his opponents, which had determined it. The impossibility of revealing this to Madame de Malreuve only made the difficulty shut in more darkly around him, and in the completeness of his discouragement he scarcely needed a reminder of his promise to regard the subject as closed, when once the other side had defined its position. He was secretly confirmed in this acceptance of his fate by the knowledge that it was really he who had defined the position. Even now that he was alone with Madame de Malreuve, and subtly aware of the struggle under her composure, he felt no temptation to abate his stand by a jot. He had not yet formulated a reason for his resistance. He simply went on feeling more and more strongly with every precious sign of her participation in his unhappiness that he could neither owe his escape from it to such a transaction, nor suffer her, innocently, to owe hers. The only mitigating effect of his determination was in an increase of helpless tenderness toward her, so that, when she exclaimed, in answer to his announcement, that he meant to leave Paris the next night, "Give me a day or two longer," he at once resigned himself to saying, "If I can be of the least use, I'll give you 100. She answered sadly that all he could do would be to let her feel that he was there just for a day or two, till as he had readjusted herself to the idea of going on in the old way, and on this note of renunciation they parted. But Durham, however pledged to the passive part, could not long sustain it without rebellion. To hang round the shut door of his hopes seemed, after 2 long days, more than even his passion required of him, And on the 3rd he dispatched a note of goodbye to his friend. He was going off for a few weeks. He explained his mother and sisters wished to be taken to the Italian lakes. But he would return to Paris and say his real farewell to her before sailing for America in July. He had not intended his note to act as an ultimatum. He had no wish to surprise Madame de Malleroux into unconsidered surrender. When, almost immediately, his own messenger returned with a reply from her, he even felt a pang of disappointment, a momentary fear lest she should have stooped a little from the high place where his passion had preferred to leave her. But her first words turned his fear into rejoicing. "Let me see you before you go. Something extraordinary has happened," she wrote. What had happened, as he heard from her a few hours later, finding her in a tremor of frightened gladness, with her door boldly closed to all the world but himself, was nothing less extraordinary than a visit from Madame de Trames, who had come, officially delegated by the family, to announce that Monsieur de Malleroux had decided not to oppose his wife's suit for divorce. Durham, at the news, was almost Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.